English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran imposes sanctions on over a dozen US individuals and entities for human rights violations, inciting violence and economic terrorism. Armenia and Azerbaijan attend a tripartite meeting in Russia. They agree not to use force to resolve their disputes over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Also ahead, Russia's president accuses Ukraine of using a safe shipping corridor to attack its Crimea fleet, calling on Kiev to guarantee the safety of maritime traffic. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story. Iran has imposed sanctions on a number of American individuals and entities for offenses including human rights violations and supporting terrorism. Iran's foreign ministry says they were also sanctioned for interfering in Iran's internal affairs, instigating violence and riots in the country, and committing economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. 10 individuals and 4 entities are on the black list. They include the commander of the U.S. Central Command, the U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, the CIA, and the U.S. National Guard. Over the past few weeks, the U.S. and its allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Iran over what they call a crackdown on anti-government protests. Iran dismisses the allegations, saying it's dealing with foreign-backed riots. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Navy has seized a foreign tanker carrying 11 million liters of smuggled fuel in the Persian Gulf. Brigadier General Abbas Ghulam Shahi, commander of the IRGC's first naval region, says 21 crew members of the tanker have been handed over to the judiciary of the Hormozgan province. A judiciary official says investigations and legal procedures are underway. The nationality of the owners of the flagless tanker or its crew members has not been specified, but the value of its cargo is said to be more than $6.5 million. Iranian forces have seized a number of smugglers' vessels in the Persian Gulf in recent months. Iran's navy has ramped up its efforts against smuggling in the strategic waterway, where a large amount of the world's oil is both produced and shipped. The Russian president is calling on Ukraine to guarantee the safety of Black Sea traffic after Moscow suspended participation in a UN-brokered grain shipment deal. Vladimir Putin accused Kiev of using the shipping corridor for an attack on Russia's Crimea fleet. The Russian Defense Ministry also called on the UN to obtain the required guarantees from Ukraine. Moscow says the decision to halt the implementation of the deal was prompted by a Ukrainian drone attack on Russian ships in Crimea. Kiev has dismissed the allegation as a false pretext. Russia's move has also angered Ukraine's Western allies. The US has called the move purely outrageous. Also, the EU and NATO have asked Russia to reverse its decision. The Western military alliance urged Russia to stop, quote, weaponizing food. Russian President Vladimir Putin has held a trilateral summit with the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in the wake of tensions between the two ex-Soviet neighbors. In a joint statement after the talks, Baku and Yerevan agreed not to use force to resolve their disputes over the Nagorno-Karabakh territory. They also agreed to settle all disputes solely on the basis of the recognition of mutual sovereignty and territorial integrity. Marina Kurtanova reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in an attempt to help the two ex-Soviet states settle their long-standing conflict. Putin said he's hopeful that the summit will make it possible to outline steps to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, adding the Armenian leadership has the political will to resolve the conflict with Azerbaijan. Putin, however, noted Moscow does not impose anything on anyone and only offers a peaceful solution.
I know that you have the political will for this, and we support it in every possible way. We must find the key points that will allow us to move forward. This conflict has been going on for decades, so we still need to end it sometime.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan reacted to Putin's remarks, voicing his readiness to accept Moscow's offer to establish diplomatic relations with Baku. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev also said that the Karabakh conflict has already become history and it is time to talk about the normalization of relations between Yerevan and Baku. He expressed gratitude to Russia for trying to resolve the issue. Some experts believe the U.S. and some European countries, particularly France, are trying to foment discord between Armenia from Russia, reform their friendly relations to hostility, withdraw Armenia from the CSTO, and encourage Yerevan for a new large-scale military conflict with Azerbaijan.
France is actively intervening in the conflict. NATO's interests are visible behind it. The USA has one of its largest embassies in Yerevan, the same with Azerbaijan. There goes Israel and the UK. The latter is one of Turkey's closest friends. Another block of countries is being formed there, but they all work in the same direction. They are opposed to the participation of Iran and Russia in resolving this conflict and are trying to replace the participation of neighboring states with that of Western ones. This deprives the people of Armenia and Azerbaijan of a peaceful solution.
A six-week war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 troops on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered deal that saw Yerevan cede swathes of territory that it had controlled for several decades. Last month, 286 people from both sides were killed in the flare-up of new clashes.
Moscow's task is to find ground for compromise. The interference of Turkey, France, Britain and the United States in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in recent months, the so-called Western Peace Project may simply threaten the disappearance of Nagorno-Karabakh. Most experts believe the mediation of such countries is a trap from which there is no way out. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Now, Russia recently evacuated tens of thousands of civilians from Kherson in response to Ukraine launching offenses and artillery strikes on the city. Johnny Miller speaks to refugees who recently fled the city, and many tell the stories of alleged Ukrainian war crimes.
A refugee center in Sevastopol, Crimea. Most people here have come from Kherson, a Russian-controlled city now under attack by Ukraine.
I wanted to leave Kherson because it was dangerous there. Ukrainian troops are shooting at civilians. Artillery strikes and rockets are coming from the Ukrainian side. They attack both civilian and military objects. They shell our villages, they destroy our homes and kill children.
She can't hold back the tears.
If there is any connection, I call my friends who are staying in a basement. They tell us stories. A five-story building was shelled and people hear moaning from the rubble. When people tried to rescue them, snipers killed the person who was trying to help and others ran away. Snipers are working everywhere. There was a couple working at the meat factory and the woman was pregnant. The snipers shot both of them in the back. It is Ukraine that does this. The people who remain are considered to be separatists by Ukraine.
Now, many of the people here are scared of Ukrainian reprisals. I've even met an elderly couple here. They're on the Ukrainian kill list, Mirot Verets. Why? Because they're doctors and working in a civilian hospital in Kherson, and they are viewed as Russian collaborators just for doing so.
Roughly 70% of the people in Kherson were pro-Russian and 30% were pro-Ukrainian. The evacuation took place very peacefully and quietly because it came before the military activities began. I have no complaints about the evacuation. The city might be slightly destroyed, but what is more important is that it stays in our hands and victory will be ours.
While pro-Ukrainians may dispute her percentage claim, with Russia forcibly evacuating tens of thousands of civilians from the city, they are now turning it into a fortress, with less risk of either side killing civilians.
Some refugees signed papers to receive financial support. Then they returned 2 weeks later and asked for psychological help. Some people adapt easily, but later they need to talk it out. Some need work immediately, but others need cultural activities to forget the past life and switch to normal life in Sevastopol.
A map in the office. The four regions now claimed by Russia has been colored in with a highlighter. How much more or less will be painted pink will be decided in the coming months, perhaps even years. Meanwhile, it is civilians on both sides of the battle lines who continue to be killed or have their lives turned to turmoil. Johnny Miller, Sevastopol, Crimea.
Russia is accusing Western countries of trying to recruit its diplomats in the Netherlands. It has summoned the Dutch ambassador to convey strong protests over the, quote, unacceptable move. The Russian Foreign Ministry says a UK spy attempted to recruit the military attaché of Russia's embassy in The Hague late last month. The ministry said that Western secret services, including the CIA, have attempted several similar provocations in the Netherlands in recent years. Moscow said the Netherlands had also taken part in the plots. Relations between Russia and the West have severely worsened after Moscow launched the war in Ukraine. Western countries have since imposed sanctions on Moscow and expelled hundreds of Russian diplomats, accusing some of spying. Russia has retaliated by sending home Western diplomats. Turning elsewhere now, a Democratic U.S. senator is calling for an investigation into continued Saudi ownership of Twitter shares following Elon Musk's takeover of the social media company. Chris Murphy says he wants a probe into the national security implications of the purchase. He added that the Saudis have a clear interest in repressing political speech, and the U.S. should be concerned that they are Twitter's second largest owner. Murphy asked the Committee on Foreign Investment to conduct the probe. That's a powerful Treasury-led committee that reviews transactions for national security concerns. Saudi billionaire Al-Waleed bin Talal and the Kingdom Holding Company say they will continue their ownership of Twitter shares. The decision comes as Saudi Arabia has long been under the international community's spotlight over its flagrant violation of human rights and continued crackdown on freedom of expression. China urges the United States to stop its attempts to contain and suppress Beijing and avoid creating obstacles to bilateral relations. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi made the comments in a telephone call with his U.S. counterpart Antony Blinken. Wang also called on Washington not to let itself be blinded by ideological bias while dealing with China. According to a statement by the U.S. State Department, Blinken and Wang also discussed the need to responsibly manage U.S.-China relations. The world's two top economies have recently struck a conciliatory tone toward each other. Just days ago, U.S. President Joe Biden said his country does not seek conflict with China, and President Xi Jinping said China is willing to work with the U.S. to find ways to get along to the benefit of both and for the sake of global security and peace. North Korea has called on the United States and South Korea to stop their joint large-scale military drills. It's warning that the war games are a provocation that may draw more powerful follow-up measures. The foreign ministry said the situation on the Korean Peninsula has entered a serious confrontation phase due to, quote, reckless U.S.-South Korea military moves. The ministry warned that Washington and Seoul have to take the blame for all the consequences if they do not stop their military exercises all at once. The U.S. and South Korea began one of their largest joint military air drills on Monday. The operation will run until Friday and will feature about 240 warplanes. Washington and Seoul say Pyongyang may be about to resume testing of nuclear bombs for the first time since 2017, and that's why they are holding the drills. Pyongyang, however, views the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion. The death toll from the collapse of a pedestrian suspension bridge in Western India has risen to 137. The Indian Prime Minister expresses sadness over the tragedy in his home state and says rescue operations are ongoing.
My condolences to the families of the people who have lost their lives in this accident. In this hour of grief, the government is with the bereaved families in every manner. The Gujarat government has been carrying out the rescue operations with all its might since last evening.
Most of those who had died were women, children, or elderly. The death toll is expected to rise as rescuers are combing through the river to find the missing ones. More than 177 people have been rescued so far. Police say 9 people associated with the company that maintained the bridge have been arrested. Hundreds of people were on the bridge when it collapsed on Sunday. The bridge was overcrowded as people had come there to celebrate Diwali or the Festival of Lights. The structure had only reopened to the public last week after undergoing renovation. It was originally built during British rule in the 19th century. And that brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The recent decision by OPEC Plus to reduce daily oil production has angered Democratic officials in the United States in the Biden administration. With the reduction of OPEC Plus daily production, the price of oil will rise, and it will also increase the price of gasoline in the United States. And this will reduce Democratic chances in the upcoming midterm elections this November. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. the Sputnik News Agency has more for us. Coordinator for Strategic Communications at the National Security Council in the White House, John Kirby, claimed the recent OPEC Plus decision to cut oil production contradicts the talks between the Biden administration and Saudi Arabia on boosting oil output. John Kirby stated during a press briefing on Wednesday, 26th of October, he said, OPEC Plus decision to cut oil production certainly wasn't in keeping with the conversations that we were having with Saudi Arabia. John Kirby recalled that the United States discussed the issue with the Saudi leadership before and during President Joe Biden's visit to the Desert Kingdom last July, and there was an increase in oil production in the aftermath of his trip. OPEC Plus unanimously agreed in early October to decrease oil production by 2 million barrels per day starting in November, in response to uncertainty in global energy markets. Accusing Saudi Arabia of aligning itself with Russia, the Biden administration condemned the supply cut as short-sighted amid rising energy prices in the United States and Europe. Riyadh has rejected the accusations, saying that the decision to slash oil production was to stabilize the global market amid declining demand caused by a slowing of economies around the world. Also, several member states of OPEC Plus, the producer group consisting of organizations of the petroleum exporting countries plus its allies, expressed their endorsement of the recently agreed upon oil production cut after the United States accused Saudi Arabia of coercing others to support the move. The OPEC Plus decision has sharply angered US President Joe Biden, who threatened consequences for Saudi Arabia. Washington said the cut would boost Russia's foreign earnings. Saudi Arabia's defense minister and King Salman's son, Prince Khalid bin Salman, noted that the decision was unanimous. Khalid bin Salman's remarks were backed by ministers of several OPEC Plus member states, including Iraq. Iraq's state oil marketer, SOMO, said in a statement recently, "There is complete consensus among OPEC Plus countries that the best approach in dealing with the oil market conditions during the current period of uncertainty and lack of clarity is a preemptive approach that supports market stability and provides the guidance needed for the future." The United Arab Emirates also echoed the Iraqi and Saudi remarks, with the Emirati Energy Minister, Sohail Al-Mazrui, saying in a tweet, "I would like to clarify that the latest OPEC Plus decision, which was unanimously approved, was a purely technical decision with no political intentions whatsoever." The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Biden White House claimed on Thursday, 13th of October, that Saudi Arabia pushed other OPEC Plus nations into an output cut recently, part of an escalating war of words between Washington and Riyadh. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told reporters, "More than one OPEC member disagreed with Saudi Arabia's push to cut production and felt coerced into the vote." John Kirby said he was not going to identify the members to let them speak for themselves. Pushing against Riyadh's claims that the output cut was purely economic, John Kirby said in an earlier statement that the United States presented Saudi Arabia with an analysis showing there was no market basis for lower oil production before the OPEC Plus decision to cut output. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement recently, "The OPEC Plus decision was adopted through consensus, took into account the balance of supply and demand, and was aimed at curbing market volatility." John Kirby said in a statement, "The Saudi Foreign Ministry can try to spin or deflect, but the facts are simple, saying that cutting output would increase Russian revenues and blunt the effectiveness of sanctions against Moscow. The Biden administration's National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the United States analysis also showed the cut could have waited until the next OPEC meeting after the November U.S. midterm elections that will determine whether President Joe Biden's Democratic Party will remain in control of Congress. Russia Today has also covered the same story. Saudi Arabia's energy minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, criticized nations for tapping their emergency oil stockpiles in order to manipulate prices and warned of consequences if the reserves run dry. The Saudi minister told the Future Initiative Investment Conference in Riyadh on Tuesday, 25th of October, "It is my profound duty to make clear to the world that losing emergency stocks may be painful in the months to come." He noted that the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve was not intended to relieve price pressures, but instead was meant to address emergency supply constraints. The comments come after U.S. President Joe Biden announced the sale of another 14 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve of the United States following the release of 180 million barrels of oil since April. Recently, the U.S. authorities said they would release additional crude from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to keep a lid on America's gasoline prices and then replenish the reserves. The historic use of emergency stocks has worried investors around the world, as excessive volumes of oil could flood the market and put it under pressure. According to an oil analyst at Energy Aspects, Amrita Sen, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve now absolutely being used to keep prices lower, even though that's not what it's meant to be used for. The Biden administration has reportedly indicated that further tapping of the strategic reserves could be linked to the recent decision by OPEC Plus to cut oil production.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, brothers and sisters from all around the world You are listening my voice from IRIB English Radio And today I have the honor to be the host of today's episode I am Beta at your service And with me I have two dear guests Brother Ali, hello, how are you doing?
Assalamu alaikum, thank you
Assalamu alaikum
and for inviting me, it's a pleasure to
it's
be here
It's a pleasure for me too And brother Amit here
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So, we're going to go through our topic today. As you know, all the women around the world are somehow different and making hijab or something like that. But one of the most important signs of Islamic women and Muslims who are women is hijab. And we are known around the world by our hijab and the way we are appear in the society, actually. So, in the last episode, we talked about the obligatory hijab and why this obligation is something that we have to accept in our society. The thing is, I'm going to just elaborate it more to you and ask you, my dear brother, Amit, I want you to answer my question that is there any flexibility in the degree of your covering yourself? I mean, for example, if you go to London, if you go to New York, if you to go somewhere that there are some dressing codes that are somehow opener than what you have in your own country in your own Islamic country, can you follow their rules? and at the same time have your own beliefs and have your own Islamic beliefs, actually.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think I should refer to a verse that will first destroy me and then I will fix myself in the way. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, He says, لا إكراه في الدين. There is no compulsion in religion. And this verse has been quoted by many of the opposition just to justify that there is no form of compulsion in religion whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Just to give you a context of this verse. This verse was revealed when the Ansar, the companions of the Noble Prophet in Medina, they were forcing their kids to accept Islam. If we look at the history of Islam, the Prophet, when he migrated to Medina, mm-hmm. Those who came with him were Muhajir, they mm-hmm. were migrants, and those who were there helping the Prophet, they were considered Ansar, those the helpers. The Ansar, they were very clean people, but some of their kids, of course, they did not accept Islam in the first instance, so they were forcing. This is when the ayah, La Ikraha Fid-Din, revealed. This verse was revealed. They say, look, don't force your kids, don't force anyone to the religion. Following religion, you know, accepting the religion itself. And when I mean religion, I don't mean the religion Islam versus Christianity. Mm-hmm. I mean religion Islam by its extensive meaning, taslim ilallah.
Yeah.
Meaning submissive to God Almighty. Right? Don't be very aggressive when it comes to, you know, putting, you know, forcing people to accept Islam. Right? When the person accepts Islam, right? Now, we're not talking about a specific country, Islamic country, non-Islamic country. We're talking about a Muslim now, right? Mm-hmm. When a person accepts Islam, he accepts it with its entirety. There was a group of people when the Prophet approached them and he told them, accept the religion, and he convinced them. They went and they had their discussion with their elders and they came back, look, we're going to accept your Islam, we're going to pray, we're going to do whatever you say, but there are three things we're not going to accept. I'm just going to say two things so that we in the interest of time. The first one, they said, our main job is to, for example, loot the caravans who travel, right? This is the way we get money. This is the way we earn money.
Mm-hmm.
You are saying that thievery is not allowed in your religion. Exceptional. Make it exceptional for us so that we are allowed to what? Go and loot the caravans who are traveling, the trade caravans. The second one is, forgive the prayer for us. You see, we are Arabs. We are, we see ourselves as esteemed people. You're telling me to bow in front of, something that we cannot see five times a day? No, forgive this from us.
Yeah.
The Prophet said, look, if you're going to accept Islam to its entirety. If you're living in a country, let me make it into a more acceptable.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're living in a country, if you're going to live as a citizen of that country, you have to accept all the laws of that country. You can't say, I'm going to accept, for example, the traffic laws. I'm going to accept the laws, for example, of, trade. But I'm not going to accept the laws of, for example, the educational laws there.
Mm-hmm.
You're a citizen of that country. You're obliged to do that. You've, kind of given your hand of allegiance to that country.
Okay, I understand it. So you're telling me that because I accept Islam, it means that I have to accept all the
exactly.
things that exist in this religion. So I'm going to tell you that, for example, there is someone here in an Islamic country that is not Muslim, is Christian, is, I don't know, every other religion. So why should that person make a job too?
Comes to the legislation of that country. You see, a person who is...
So you're telling me there is an obligation to have hijab here?
There is an obligation.
There is obligation.
There are two perspectives over here. The first perspective is the Islamic perspective. You as a Muslim,
yeah.
Wherever you go, you're in Europe, you're in North America, South America, wherever you go,
actually, that's another story I want to hear
okay.
with you.
But when it comes to, for example, the laws of the country, the legislation of the country, you're in Iran. You have to follow the dress code of Iran. Now, whether you be a Muslim or non-Muslim, this country has been... developed and the legislations of this country have been developed based on specific values. These specific values kind of conclude that the dress code of a man should be like this and a woman should be like this. Now, whatever those values are, right now, that's not your position to discuss. This is when it comes to legislation. When it comes to you as a Muslim, whether you be in Iran or you be in India, you be in China, you have to oblige yourself to the dress code that Islam prescribes for you. In addition to that, now let me ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
Why in France, for example,
mm-hmm.
where they call the civilization of freedom or whatnot, why is it that women are obliged to remove their headscarf when they get to the university?
because, you know, this is, again, this obligation, you know. Actually, I think that our generation, you know, I think I'm the candidate of the new generation here. Our generation want exactly the thing you are telling me. I mean, a person who is choosing to wear hijab should be the same value, should be of the same value, should be of the same, you know, rule everything in a society as the person who choose not to wear hijab. You know, not to wear a scarf. So I think there should be a balance here. I mean, I'm not opposing hijab or something at all. I'm just telling you that, okay, if someone, for example, wants to do that, okay, do that. If you don't want to do that, don't do that. There shouldn't be any obligation. Not in that way, not in that way, you know, not, if, for example, in Islamic countries, not, for example, in France at all. I just don't accept none of them. That's it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Yes, peace and blessings
be upon the Holy Prophet
Islam
Muhammad and his progeny. I think a part of your question was answered in our previous session, but let's, I think, dive more into this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when you say that there should be a balance between the person who observes hijab and the person who does not like to observe hijab, actually it's as if you say that, okay, I like this law of the society and I dislike the other one. Because, again, we said that in our previous session that it is a social right for the people. For example, for me, for the other, for another person, for another brother or another sister who lives in this society, that his or her right should be observed. So this is not rationally accepted to say that, okay, I'm living in this society and the rules of this society says that you have to observe hijab and I don't want to care for that. Look, as I said earlier, some of the acts of worship, or even some, not even the acts of worship, some of the duties of ours are social and have some social denotation and connotation. So this social aspect of it does not let us to actually be indifferent towards that. Referring to your first question that you have been asking, that in case we are going to move to flexibility to when we are migrating or, let's say, moving to another area or, let's say, another country, I have to say that, look, when you have adapted Islam, when you have adopted Islam as a religion,
mm-hmm.
then we talked about it earlier, we cannot be against selective in it. So that's why before we move, before we migrate, there are some rules and regulations for us in Islamic laws. I don't know if you have seen them or not. Islam tells us, check if the society that you are going to migrate observes the way, I mean, lets you to observe your Islamic practices or not.
Yeah.
So before even migrating, that's why even there are a set of rules for those who have migrated from an Islamic land to an non-Islamic one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Islam tells you, in case they are going to deprive you from your Islamic, let's say, rights, so it's not you are not allowed to go there. You see? Islam.
So let me ask you a question here. For example, just consider that I'm a student in Iran, and I want to go abroad to study my lessons and to, you know, I don't know, improve my knowledge for my country, actually. Mm-hmm. And this is my goal. This is my intention and something like that. So I have a good intention here. And, you know, for going to that university, for example, that so-called university in another country, mm-hmm. I have to change the way I have to be. I have, you know, not to wear hijab or something like that. Mm-hmm. And here, what should I do? You know, I have a good intention, but to achieve this intention, I have to change myself.
Look, the rules of God, the laws of God cannot be changed. I mean, that's why. Then it's your time to sacrifice for the sake of your religion.
But I'm sacrificing the benefit of my country, of my, I don't know, of the people. I'm going for more knowledge because, for example, my country, I don't know, the where I live is not enough for me.
Look,
you know?
Sister, the
I want to go for something more.
Yeah, the mind that actually has legislated such a thing definitely will open some other ways for the person to find some way out of it to reach to that goal and destination.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that to say that 100% the thing that I'm going to find is exactly in that center of the world. This is not something.
It's not like
with regard to knowledge, if a person claims such a thing, it means that he has no idea of what knowledge and science is in today's world.
You're telling me that I have to sacrifice this opportunity because I have to be faithful to the guidelines I've accepted here.
Definitely,
you know?
Not. So, moreover, when you look at the world today, very, mm-hmm. very, very few countries are the ones that actually oblige you to, for example, not to observe Islamic rulings, Islamic rays
yeah,
and covering.
Yeah. But,
I mean, I can't even hardly name, for example, France and one other country.
Yeah.
So, we are not going to talk about exceptions. Let's talk about, prevalent in the world, right?
You know what? There is an
exception
too.
Exceptions can be found in any part of
the
world.
Yeah,
considering the exceptions, at what cost? Or let me put it in this way: I have a friend who came, a classmate rather, who came from the States. And he left Stanford University at what cost? Because Stanford University, at the time when he was about to be a student over there, there were a movement of racial supremacists, the white supremacists, mm-hmm. who would find any non-white person in the campus and somehow kill that person, right?
Yeah.
At what cost did he not study? He was a neuroscientist. You know, it's a very important career in this day and age. But he left that. Why? Because to safeguard his life. Now, let's take it to another level. You, as a sister or a brother, at what cost are you going towards that knowledge? Yes, in Islam itself, you know, Islamically speaking, the Prophet said, اطلب العلم ولو بالصين, right? Earn knowledge, you know, seek knowledge, even if it is from China. There is no border for knowledge, but look at the cost that you're giving for that knowledge. Will you, as a person, would still go to study in a place where the rate of rapes for women is higher than usual? Would you still go? It's for improvement, isn't it?
Yeah.
You would still question that place because you're looking at the cost, the what do you have to give? So, likewise for the hijab, the value that you're giving away while removing the hijab and studying at the same time is not worth it.
No, I got it. Actually, I really appreciate your conversation, and I think I'm convinced somehow. I wish our listeners who are enjoying our conversation too. And that was all for the two-day episode. Thank you, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. Farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept that. يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The United Nations, in its recent report, has warned that the planet could see cataclysmic 2.9 degrees Celsius of heating by 2100. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams wrote, a United Nations report published recently ahead of November's COP27 talks warns that planetary heating could reach a catastrophic 2.9 degrees Celsius by the end of the century without immediate action from the world's largest polluters to dramatically rein in carbon emissions and transition away from fossil fuels. The analysis by the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, examines the climate commitments of the 193 national parties to the Paris Climate Accord, which sets out to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, an amount of heating that would still have devastating impacts across the world, particularly in poor and low-lying nations. Even if countries meet their current climate targets, something many nations are not on track to achieve as climate advocates and scientists push for bolder actions, including the U.S. regime, global carbon emissions are projected to rise 10.6% by 2030. Relative to 2010 levels, and the planet is set to warm by an average of 2.1 to 2.9 degrees Celsius by 2100. The latest UN report is another reminder that we are still just throwing cups of water at a raging inferno. Jamie Henn, director of Fossil Free Media, wrote on Twitter, adding, it's past time for U.S. President Joe Biden to declare a climate emergency and use every power he has to get us off fossil fuels. The report notes that while some progress has been made toward reducing planet warming emissions over the past year, an urgent need for either a significant increase in the level of ambition of nationally determined contributions between now and 2030 or a significant overachievement of climate action plans will be necessary to avert disastrous warming. The New York Times noted that just 26 of 193 countries that agreed last year to step up their climate actions have followed through with more ambitious plans. The downward trend in emissions expected by 2030 shows that nations have made some progress this year, said Simon Steele, the executive secretary of UN Climate Change, adding, but the science is clear, and so are our climate goals under the Paris Agreement. We are still nowhere near the scale and pace of emission reductions required to put us on track towards a 1.5 degrees Celsius world. Steele added, to keep this goal alive, national governments need to strengthen their climate action plans now and implement them in the next 8 years. The report was published as extreme weather made more intense by the climate emergency continues to ravage large swathes of the globe, taking lives, destroying communities, and exacerbating the intertwined crises of poverty, hunger, and inequality. Millions are reeling from devastating flooding in Nigeria and Pakistan, while East Africa is in the midst of a starvation crisis intensified by prolonged drought. The potential impacts of 2.9 degrees Celsius of warming are stark. As Scott Culp, a computational scientist at Climate Central, told BuzzFeed last year, An estimated 12% of the current global population living on land could be threatened under long-term future sea level rise under the 3 degrees Celsius scenario, Culp noted, so that amounts to 810 million people. Another expert, Rutgers University climate scientist Robert Cobb, told the outlet that the more we push the system above 2 degrees Celsius, but we don't know how much, the more the chance we trigger ice sheet processes that could rapidly increase sea level rise. Samah Shukri, Egypt's Minister of Foreign Affairs and President Designate of the upcoming COP27 talks, said in a statement that the new UNFCCC report is further testimony to the fact that we are off track on achieving the Paris climate goal and keeping the 1.5 degrees within reach. Shukri said, raising ambition and urgent implementation is indispensable for addressing the climate crisis. This includes cutting and removing emissions faster and at wider scope of economic sectors to protect us from more severe adverse climate impacts and devastating loss and damage. This is a sobering moment, and we are in a race against time. Several of those who are expected to do more are far from doing enough, and the consequences of this is affecting lives and livelihoods across the globe. I am conscious that it is and should be a continuum of action until 2030 and 2050. However, these alarming findings merit a transformative response at COP27. Al Jazeera English also had an eye on this issue, writing, "The planet is heading for climate catastrophe. The UN has warned, as a report showed, how far off track nations are on cutting global warming pollution." The UN Environment Programme, UNEP, released its annual emissions gap report showing that current commitments by governments to curb the rise of global temperature are woefully inadequate. Current government climate policies leave the world on track to reach an average 2.8 degrees Celsius temperature rise this century, the report said, while implementation of current pledges will lower the rise of temperature to 2.4 to 2.6 degrees Celsius this century. Government officials will meet from November 6th to 18th at the COP27 climate talks in Egypt to discuss how to limit the warming to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and ideally to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Last year, leaders made additional pledges at the COP26 summit in Glasgow, hoping to reduce emissions. Since the climate talks in Scotland, additional commitments were made to remove 5/10 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent greenhouse gas emissions, less than 1% of estimated global emissions in 2030, the annual UN Environment Programme report showed. Policies in place without a strengthening will likely lead to a 2.8 degrees Celsius rise in temperature by the end of the century, 1/10 degrees Celsius higher than was estimated last year. UNEP Executive Director Ignar Andersson said, "We had our chance to make incremental changes, but that time is over. Only a root and branch transformation of our economies and societies can save us from accelerating climate disaster. To reach the goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, annual emissions must be reduced by 45% compared with emissions forecast under current policies. The move requires the investment of at least $4 to $6 trillion a year," the report said. "It's another year squandered in terms of currently actually doing something about the problem. That's not to say that all nations have not taken this seriously, but from a global perspective, it's definitely very far from adequate. report lead author Anne Olhoff said. According to a separate UN report earlier this week, analyzing the latest pledges submitted by countries, 2.5 degrees Celsius of warming is likely by the end of the century. Simon Steele, Executive Secretary of UN Climate Change, in a statement said, "We are still nowhere near the scale and pace of emission reductions required to put us on track toward a 1.5 degrees Celsius world. Under the 2015 Paris deal, countries are required to submit ever deeper emission cutting plans known as nationally determined contributions or NDCs. UNEP found that unconditional NDCs, which countries plan regardless of external support, would likely limit global warming to 2.6 degrees Celsius by 2100, a level that scientists warn would be catastrophic for humanity and for nature." Conditional NDCs, which rely on international funding to achieve, would likely see a 2.4 degrees Celsius temperature rise this century. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres stressed that carbon neutrality goals are useless if not backed by action, adding that the world cannot afford any more greenwashing. "Commitments to net zero are worth zero without the plans, policies, and actions to back it up," he said in a video message. "Global and national climate commitments are falling pitifully short," Guterres said in the video, which comes less than 2 weeks before the start of COP27. Guterres said, in other words, "We are headed for a global catastrophe."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.